So this is our Simone Don reading group. We're continuing with our reading of Imagination and Invention, the most recently translated text from Simone Don. So last time we finished the introduction, and we'll pick up on part one of the book. So that's page 29 of the translation. Yeah, so in the introduction, he's given these sort of nested hierarchies of the image. He gave us the three sort of moments of a cycle of the image, three phases is the term he uses. So, and these correspond to moments of time. So there's the image before the encounter with the object, or the image as anticipation. So this is connected with the moment of the future. Then there's the image in interaction with the object, or in the encounter with the object. So this is the image in connection with the present. And then there is the image after the encounter with the object, which corresponds to the moment of the past. So these are the three phases of the sort of general cycle of the image. Then after those three phases run through, there's sort of a change of gear, and then the cycle begins again at a higher level of structuration, I guess we can say. Sort of change of gear moment corresponds to what Simone Don calls invention. So this can be like, you know, an actual invention of a technical object, where you might observe some sort of machine. And then after that observation, you think about, you know, how the machine works. And then you perform some act of invention, and you create a new machine that modifies the existing machine and does something different. That's sort of one example, but it can also be an artistic creation, or an invention, a sort of conceptual invention, where you figure out how two concepts that seem contradictory, or two ideas that seem contradictory, you figure out a way of making them compatible with each other. Invention can happen in multiple different domains of human existence, I guess we can say. So there's those three phases, and then within each of those three phases, we have those three phases are repeated at these three levels. So we have three phases and then three levels. And so each phase reoccurs at each level. And so the levels that he identifies are first the biological or vital level. So here it has to do, the role of the image is related to the organism as a whole. So it's the whole organism that responds in relation to an image. So in anticipation, we have what he relates to this concept from ethology. So the study of animal behavior, in the German term is Leerlaufreaktion. This is known as like a empty behavior, I guess, or I forget exactly what the English translation is, but it's in animal behavior, you often have these sort of repetitive action patterns. So animals have a particular way of eating or drinking or moving around or whatever behavior that animal does. So that species of animal has a specific way of performing each of those activities. And in certain motivational contexts, the animals will perform that behavior even without the object that normally the behavior is oriented towards. So they might, if an animal is hungry enough, it might sort of perform the action of catching and eating its prey without the prey actually being present. So this is like anticipation at the biological level. And then the second phase at the biological level is the phase of perception, where the image is in interaction with an object and is meant to sort of correspond to the way the object is. So the object has certain properties, and your perception should depict the object as having matching properties. And then there's also the third phase of the I should sort of specify the second phase is not so much properties as patterns. The organism at this level recognizes patterns such as, you know, this is a a potential mate. This is a predator. This is prey, whatever. There's sort of fixed patterns of what kinds of entities there are in the world to encounter that the organism recognizes at this second phase of the first level. And then the third phase of the first level is learning. So organisms are capable of learning, you know, if I press this lever, then food comes out, or if I press this other lever, then I get an electric shock. And this is a sort of an artificial environment, but in natural environments, they learn, you know, eating this kind of berry makes me sick, so I'm not going to eat this berry anymore. Things like that. So animals are, and organisms in general are capable of learning. Then the second level is what Simondon calls the psychological level, but though he says this term is far from satisfactory. And this one is distinguished from the first one in that it's no longer the whole organism that responds to the image, but it's the image has a sort of partial nature in this case. So the organism is capable of relating itself to an image and then sort of using that image to define its future behavior or its the way it's going to respond, but not in a sort of total manner like in the first one. So instead of running away or attacking or whatever, an organism might have an image of an object that allows it to make decisions about how to respond to that object. So I don't know if I need to go through each phase one by one of this level, but we'll go through it eventually when we get there in the main body of the text. So I'll just sort of skip over that for now, and then I'll move on to the third level. And this is the one that Simondon calls the reflexive level. And this is the maybe the most difficult one to grasp exactly what's going on. But here it's even more removed from the situation, whereas so the first biological level, the organism just sort of responds immediately to the situation. The second psychological level, the organism has a sort of differentiated response to the situation. It can take in information about different aspects of the situation and sort of weigh options and then make a decision. And then the third level is sort of a reflection on that activity itself. And so this corresponds to conceptual thought and reflection about how our mental life works in general. So he identifies these sort of these images that are sort of underlying various philosophical doctrines and also religious ideas and so on. He talks about, for example, the image that he sees as underlying Platonism and Neoplatonism, and then Bergson's doctrine of élan vital. Is a kind of image of overflowing or coming outside of yourself or this sort of outward directed movement. So there's a sort of motor schema of this outward directed movement that underlies the sort of development of each of these theories. Those are the three phases and the three levels. And so what we're going to see in the body of the text is he's going to go through, so in part one, he's going to go through each of the levels and each of the phases in terms of the motor content of images. So image understood as directing or orienting action of an organism. So that's sort of where we are now. And we'll pick up, so we're going to start with the image prior to the experience of the object. So the anticipation image, and then we're going to start at the biological level and then proceed to the psychological and reflexive levels. Angus, would you like to read the first, subsection up until subsection 2, please?
Yeah, no problem. Part 1, the motor content of images, the image prior to the experience of the object, A, or section A. Biological givens, how motricity precedes sensoriality. Subsection 1, the phylogenetic aspect. The development of motricity precedes that of sensoriality, virtualization. To say that motricity precedes sensoriality amounts to affirming that the stimulus response schema is not absolutely primary. It refers to a situation or a present relation between the organism and the milieu that has already been prepared by an activity of the organism during its growth. Herbert Spencer Jennings' work on the simplest organisms has shown that reactions, behavior in the presence of an object, are preceded by spontaneous motor activities that exist prior to the reception of the characteristic signals of an object. In fact, the very notion of an object should be analyzed with precision. It corresponds to a mode in the organism's relation to its milieu, one that implies a highly organized reception of signals. Among the simplest species, the perception of an object can appear in the course of spontaneous non-reactive activities. Responses, comportement de réponse, to an object might be more frequent than spontaneous activities in the more advanced species, but among the lowest species, the opposite is the case. Spontaneous behaviors are necessary and permanent anticipations of perception. These behaviors reveal the existence of a local activity which, even if it ultimately disappears behind the finalized activities of object seeking, continue to provide the basis of anticipations. And we may conjecture that among higher organisms, such anticipating spontaneity is preserved but integrated within the activity of the nervous system under the guise of a source of initiatives or a function of endogenous novelty that is the basis of invention and the engine of structural changes that the individual can effect on the inner organization of its analogical representation of the milieu. According to this hypothesis, the activity manifested in Brownian movements among lower organisms or in trial and error behaviors would provide the most primitive aspect of what will become the genesis of anticipating images among organisms endowed with a highly centralized and strongly telencephalized nervous system. Indeed, randomness or chance comes not only from the stimuli coming from the milieu carrying information. It is efficaciously developed, it is efficaciously deployed from an endogenous source, that of the initiatives of the organism as it encounters the milieu. The perceptual motor relation is already act two in the drama where two protagonists, organism and milieu, exist, each as a primordial source of novelty and chance. It is the encounter of these two novelties that generates the perceptual relation. To the bundle of signals and exogenous novelty corresponds the local activity of an endogenous anticipation coming from the organism, the first form of the a priori image, whose content is essentially motor. We must posit, then, that the first form of anticipation before the organism's relation to the object is the set of activities that make the organism an autokinetic system, without the pronounced directionality of Brownian movements, as Viaud has observed in the dispersion of a population in a homogeneous milieu, the center of gravity remaining fixed. This activity is only slowed down or accelerated by conditions in the milieu, thermokinesis or photokinesis, but not polarized by it. Brownian movements and kinesis are more primary and more constant than tropisms. Tropisms themselves, still very primitive, display an orientation but do not affect an adaptation. They represent a reaction to agents more than to true objects, and thus preserve an important part of the autokinetic character of the primary behavior of the organism. Only with the quote-unquote pathies, or the behaviors Jennings calls quote-unquote avoidance reactions, does a true reaction to an object occur, an adapted reaction modeled on perceptual behaviors. To state that motricity precedes sensoriality in the development of a species is to affirm that the most primitive living beings execute a great number of movements, which come to nothing because their perceptual apparatus is too undeveloped and to direct these movements and endow them with efficacy, finality, and economy. The motor apparatus is in advance of the sensorial apparatus. This leads us to believe that the priority of the motor apparatus is maintained in the development of the nervous system, but is integrated within the organism in the form of a capacity of the nervous system has to constantly generate sketches of nascent movements, which are not responses to stimuli, and which thus constitute the postulate of all new behaviors, all attempts coming from the organism and allowing it to actively confront the relation to the milieu with a complex series of possibilities and ready behaviors. Images of movement would then be, in this sense, behavior schemas ready to be actualized but still contained within the nervous system rather than affected one after the other. Of course, autokinetic behaviors can be dangerous. They can bring an organism into contact with a predator, for instance. They represent an effective means of scouting only within a milieu that is homogeneous for long stretches, as are, in general, the milieus of very rudimentary organisms of small size. As soon as discontinuities emerge, as soon as true objects appear and not simple gradients, the spontaneous anticipations can be adaptive only if they remain virtual, in the form of an attempt that remains within the organism, a fictive essay leading to the action only after receiving perceptual references that ensure an adjustment to the actual milieu. It seems like the broad point of this section is that the organism's action within the milieu can't be reduced to the perception of an object because there are these motor schema that happen prior to or independently of the perception of an object. In the case, I guess, of the Brownian motion of very simple organisms, but also it seems like these movements are preserved in more advanced organisms in the sort of sketches of action that a complex nervous system can generate, which kind of recalls the disparation of perceptive worlds, although I guess this would be prior to perception in Individuation Volume 1.
Yeah, he's here. So in Individuation, he brought up this idea that tropism is prior to perception of objects or perception in sort of the proper sense of the term. So tropism is a response to a gradient in an environment. It can be, you know, a gradient of light or of temperature or sugar concentration in a solution, for example, and all kinds of organisms direct themselves either toward or away from a certain pool of these gradients. But here he's identifying something that's prior even to tropism, which is this sort of random movement, this Brownian motion. So a Brownian motion is if you take like any sort of small particles of like dust, you know, sand or whatever in water or any other liquid, and you look at them in the microscope, there's all this sort of random motion, and you know, they'll move a particular grain of dust will move, you know, 1 micrometer one direction and then sort of float in the opposite direction 1 micrometer and just sort of move around. And it, this is actually a result of some of the sub atomic level of interactions that are sort of amplified at a visible level. So here Simondon is talking about not Brownian motion properly speaking, but like this sort of analogous motion of single-celled organisms. So if you just look at a bunch of bacteria or amoeba or whatever in a test tube under a microscope, then they just sort of move around in this quasi-random way. They just float in various directions. And Simondon points out that this, for these types of organisms, this is actually an efficient way of searching an environment. So if the organism is relying on finding sugar in the water, then just floating randomly until you find sugar is fairly efficient way of finding sugar, as opposed to having some sort of perceptual mechanism that would require all kinds of energy to identify the sugar, direct motion in that direction and so on. But it's also interesting that, so this, of course, was written in the 1960s when molecular biology was, you know, sort of in the early phases of development. And more recently, there's been actually quite a bit of research on single-celled organisms having perceptual and cognitive capacities that were not apparent at the time that Simondon was writing. So some of this, what seems to be random movement, can actually be directed to follow gradients that that maybe weren't apparent in the 60s, or to relate to the environment in adapted ways, as opposed to just sort of random movement. So like there are bacteria, for example, that they have, or was it bacteria, or it might be slime molds, I can't remember exactly, but anyway, there are single-celled organisms that they have a sort of individual free floating phase, and then they have a colony phase, and they respond to the amount of food or nutrient molecules in the environment, and they signal to each other. They release chemicals that sort of say, you know, I'm finding a lot of nutrients, or I'm not finding a lot of nutrients. And then depending on the concentration of those signaling mechanisms in the environment, these organisms will either congregate to form the collective form, or they will disperse and have their free-floating form. So there's some fairly sophisticated behavior that single-celled organisms are capable of that has only really been identified in the last couple of decades, as molecular biology is much more advanced now than it was in the 60s. I think the sort of general point that motricity is sort of more fundamental than sensorial reality is something we can probably still hold on to, but some of the details of which organisms have this sort of random motricity, that may not actually sort of hold up anymore in terms of contemporary biology.
This, where he talks about the two kinds of novelty, the exogenous and endogenous novelty, it sounds like he's talking about he says that this is a source of novelty and chance. So there's a kind of contingency in the preformation of the object through these motor functions in the organism prior to the encounter of the object and perception, which is a different kind of contingency.
Yeah, I think the idea here is that if there wasn't this sort of openness to contingency in the functioning of an organism, so if the organism didn't have this sort of spontaneous source of randomness in its own activity, and also if the environment was not sort of a constant source of random influences or semi-random influences, then everything would just sort of happen in a like straightforward mechanical manner. Precisely when we build machines, what we do is try to isolate them in such a way that all these random influences from the environment, heat and rain and all these other things, don't affect the mechanism. You house it inside a body or something like that. You try to make it so that the mechanism only works in one specific way, and all these other influences are excluded from the functioning of the mechanism. But then in living beings, it's sort of the opposite of that strictly mechanical operation, where the sort of internal spontaneity and then the reception of these semi-random influences from the environment are sort of interacting with each other to produce a non-mechanical result. So something that is not a linear deterministic causal chain. It's this sort of interaction of these two sources of randomness that is a prerequisite for something like an organism to be able to perceive objects in the first place. So you have to have this openness to contingency and randomness, as a prerequisite for something to be able to perceive objects. But the perception of objects is a more complicated and process that involves all sorts of other aspects, as well as this sort of reception of contingency. Okay, let's go on to subsection 2. I'll read this one. Subsection 2, the action system as ontogenetic basis of motor images. An anticipation cannot be merely an initiative. It is an organized initiative with a structure, a consistency with respect to itself, a form. Is there a biological basis for these structures that bear on the anticipation of motor behaviors? yes, under the guise of an action system that is the dynamic and kinematic equivalent of what is, as a structure, the anatomy of an organism. A species is recognizable not only through the shape of its organs, their relative size and mode of assembly, but also through behavior schemas, ways of drinking, manners of moving, leaping, crawling, seizing an object. The organism is a set of behavior schemas as clearly identifiable and with as sharp a taxonomic value as the shape of exoskeletal spurs, the number of claws, etc. Such action schemas thus exist in living beings as anticipations of possible behaviors, as partial programs of behavior, and employed virtually, they can provide a content to anticipations in the guise of preparations for situations in which the object is encountered, or the anticipation of responses. The organism can, more or less fully, rehearse its comportments before applying them to a real object, getting up, attacking, fleeing, or confronting. These are sequences whose program a living being possesses in itself the way it possesses its own body. This then forms a basis for the local activity of anticipation and may go as far as gratuitous motor play in improvised situations. But the foundation of the activity is provided by those schemes the being possesses and can elicit at any time as if it were a real situation. Such motor schemas undergird dreaming, during which, in particular, eye movements should be noted. Lucretius noticed them in sleeping dogs. Even while awake, a forcefully imagined action is accompanied by motor anticipations as its most constant organic content. Nascent voicing, muscular contractions, walking, making a fist, etc. Emotions, which are not only repercussions but also preparations for action, include motor anticipations that put the elements of the action system in play, as Darwin has shown. In anger, the pulling back of lips, uncovering teeth ready to bite, etc. There is then a semiology of corporeal posture specific to each species according to its action system. Right, so here we have more complex types of behavior than just this random motion, this sort of primal spontaneity of single-celled organisms. We're looking now at, he's primarily thinking of, mammals and birds, but multicellular organisms in general have these sort of action schemas that are specific to that species that I mentioned in the beginning of the session. So a particular way of eating or drinking or catching prey or whatever. So you can classify animals in relation to these forms of behavior in the same way that you can classify them in relation to the organs that they have. A certain animal has a certain mating ritual, for example, and that serves to isolate that animal from maybe a similar species that has a different mating ritual. It will be less likely that the two populations will interbreed because the mating rituals are incompatible with each other. So it will be less likely that the individuals from those two different species or two different populations will breed with each other. This type of motor behavior, again, is sort of prior to the perception of the object or the relationship with the object. And this is especially, he mentions dreaming as a sort of instance of this. So in dreaming, we have these sort of hallucinations of images. And then we have these sketches of motor behavior, at least eye movements this is in sleep research in psychology. Eye movements are sort of definitory of dream states. So we talk about REM sleep and rapid eye movement sleep. So the phase of sleep in which there is rapid eye movement is the phase in which you have dreams. But then there's also if you watch a dog sleeping, you'll see its feet kind of twitch, and you see it might pull back its lips and sort of start growling a little bit while it's sleeping. Dogs, and this is something Lucretius already pointed out, and I believe Aristotle as well, that you can see that a dog is dreaming just because it's you can see it sort of performing these sort of sketches of motor actions while it's sleeping. What Simondon is arguing here is that this these sketches of motor behavior are again prior to perception. So this anticipation of the object or anticipation of a motor behavior is more fundamental to biological reality than the actual perception and response to an object. So this is a sort of anti-behaviorist position to take here. So he's saying that the stimulus response loop is something that is sort of that comes later or is less fundamental in the structure of a living being than this set of motor schemas that are produced by an organism and that are characteristic of that type of organism. Okay, let's go on to subsection three. Ben, do you have your mic ready?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, if you could read the full subsection three, that would be great.
Hereditary coordinations of actions. To the elementary sequence of action systems, we can also add the hereditary coordinations, which are a part of instinctual activity, as common observation and ethological studies have both discovered. While the elements of an action system specific to each species cannot provide a basis for one species to grasp the sense of a behavior of another species, hereditary coordinations often exceed, in their generality, the species displaying it, so that they can not only feed anticipations, they can also serve as a mode of primitive communication through a sort of natural, interspecific language. A warning cry, an aggressive gathering, mating rituals, or behaviors towards the young contain an action coordination that forms an image and may be understood by other species. Moreover, such processes foreground the spontaneity of the nervous system and the play of motivation. Lorenz and Tinbergen have shown that hereditary coordination are not necessarily reactions to objects or real situations. If motivation is intense, a weak external stimulation is, and if motivation is very intense, no stimulation is required for the instinctual. Finally, after being triggered by a stimulus, instinctual actions may continue to unfold according to an entirely endogenous order. All that is missing from this action are the taxic components adapting it to their real object when present, like the rolling of eggs and the gray-legged goose. Such findings are important for research on the origins of movement images, for they show that the organism possesses a reservoir of complex schemas of behavior that can be endogenously activated if motivations are sufficient. There is therefore a veritable biological basis to the imaginary which is prior to the experience of the object. Gens has observed young captive epivorous buzzards that, in the absence of bee nests to dig up, perform gestures of bee catching as if with an imaginary nest. Pre-adapted to an object, movement is truly a practical anticipation of its presence and even of its structure. It postulates the object. The modalities of the object corresponding to hereditary coordinations are not well defined, yet there exists a certain prefiguration of the specific object corresponding to triggering of instinctual activity. Robert has studied it among male turkeys raised in isolation. A black cloth hung and fluttering in the wind triggers an aggressive behavior. A black cloth laying on the ground brings about a pre-copulating behavior. There are thus certain perceptual patterns playing the role of triggering stimuli. We need not undertake a full inventory for the analysis of motor images, but we may wonder whether in the case of very intense motivation, the endogenous activation of instinctual comportment in the absence of an adequate stimulus does not generate a hallucinatory representation of the specific stimulus induced by motor anticipation in a rough schematic way. We know, however, that images of movements do not always have as the content the anticipation of comportments inscribed in the specific program of hereditary coordination. In humans, this is the case with the images of flight. Jung provided an interpretation of such images by presuming that evolution left vestigial images in higher species coming from forms of life belonging to earlier stages of evolution. For instance, the dragon referring to a reptilian image. Such an interpretation is seductive and interesting while remaining conjectural. It might be partially confirmed by the fact that certain animals, for instance terrestrial mammals, spontaneously knew how to swim even when their species has not lived near waterways for a very long time. But we might also wonder whether motor images of flying are truly anticipations or whether they come from the perception of birds via subjective position. The frame of hereditary coordination is likely too narrow to allow the explanation of the genesis and content of all images with a motor content. Yet it shows that these images may have a content that is prior to a defined perception, even if latter this content is transformed by a complex elaboration. Concerning images of flight, we might note that in older narratives of actual attempts at flying motion schemas that are inessential for birds but very important for human locomotion, jumping and momentum, were integrated into these anticipations. The first attempts at flying were leaps into the air after running, sustained by beating wings. This shows that humans partially imagine flying through the momentum of running and long jumping that is part of their action system and occurs in their hereditary coordination. Hereditary coordination is all the more important, given the relation to a specific stimulus may be relatively random. Studies in ethology have described the phenomenon of Prägung, imprinting, in certain species. A given behavior is performed, for instance, the set of behaviors of a fledgling to its mother, yet the perception of the stimulus mother is not at all selective. A human or a dog presented at a given number of hours or days from birth are taken by the fledglings as the being to be followed. Later, the relation becomes more selective as the mother must respond to more specific signals. It is important to note, however, that the image of the mother in this case is above all the anticipation of a behavior. She is the being one can follow. Such learning, effected once and all at once, is called pragun by the ethological school. Its force and quickness illustrate the role of the image as an essentially motor anticipation of situations and the case of instinctual anticipation. A behavior is already virtually ready. All it needs is an objective support. We might wonder whether similar critical periods where pragun occurs do not show up among humans in the context of instinctual behaviors, passions, being love-struck, feeling that the partner is a predestined choice. This would constitute an origin of individual differences in the primordial categories of representation of parents, educators, perhaps associates in general, all consequences of primal experiences affected on the basis of anticipation.
Right, so here we're looking at... So not just these sort of motor actions in general, but the way that these motor actions are coordinated. So they are connected with perceptual stimuli. So there's a particular, so essentially like these ducklings or various birds will follow basically anything that moves around in their environment in the sort of early hours after hatching. So anything that sort of moves in its environment that's like roughly of the right size, and very, very roughly of the right size, because they will follow humans as well, is sort of responded to as the being to be followed, as Simon Don puts it here. So these organisms, they have a certain sort of motor schema, the following behavior, for example, or mating behavior or whatever. And then there's like certain perceptual triggers that sort of elicit this behavior. But this is one of the sort of key ideas of the early ethology of Lorenz and Tinbergen, is that, or one of the key findings that they came up with is that this sort of triggering of motor behavior is not sort of object directed, in the sense that, so it's not that the organism has a sort of overall perception of an object and then identifies that object as here's a being I can mate with or something like that. Instead, there are these sort of very schematic traits of the organism, of the entity that the organism responds to. An outline or a color contrast or something like that. These sort of very schematic traits will elicit the behavior, and sometimes even more than the normal object of that behavior. There was a species of gull, a bird, that its eggs are normally like off-white with brown spots or something like that. But the researchers, the ethologists, gave them artificial eggs that are like bright yellow with red spots. And the birds preferred these artificial eggs to their own eggs. So the perceptual color contrast of the bright yellow and the red was more powerful in eliciting the behavior than their own natural eggs. The bird here is not like seeing the egg and identifying, hey, this is an egg that I should sit on or something like that. It's instead responding to this color contrast in a sort of vaguely egg-shaped form. And it's this sort of set of traits, you know, egg form plus color contrast is eliciting the motor behavior of sitting on the object. This is sort of characteristic of a lot of organisms, where they respond to these sort of triggering traits in entities in their environment, as opposed to identifying an object as falling under a certain concept or a certain category. It's just these sort of disembodied traits that elicit their behavior. Oh, and yes, and as Angus put in the chat here, the wasp and orchid example that Deleuze and Guattari talk about in A Thousand Plateaus is a similar type of phenomenon, because the orchid has like a set of markings on it that don't especially look like a bee, but or a wasp, I should say. They don't like resemble a wasp in any sort of obvious way. It doesn't. It's not like an illusion of a wasp, but the set of markings that appears on the orchid sort of elicit the behavior in the mating behavior in the wasp, which makes it pick up pollen from one flower and then move to another flower and fertilize the second flower. Lots of other flowers do this for bees and other organisms as well. So they have markings that attract insects or sometimes birds that elicit these behaviors in birds. So there's like a sort of mutual coordination of the markings on the flower and the behavioral responses of the insect or other organism that pollinates it. So yeah, that's an interesting example of this type of phenomenon of like motor coordination.
I remember from some of the Bergson I read a while ago that in for Bergson, an image that is perceived by a given being is shaped by the capacities that that being has to act on that image. And I wonder if there's a similar idea at work here in these pre-perceptual action schemas, or what does he call them? Hereditary coordinations. That there, you know, he's in the last section he talked about claws and exoskeletal spurs, and I guess I just wonder if it's the capacities of the body of the organism that sort of reform the image that the organism can encounter.
I was thinking along the same lines that a lot of this sounds reminiscent of matter and memory specifically.
I think maybe instead of saying that the body preforms the images, I would say that maybe there's like a sort of interaction between the images and the body of the organism that sort of constitutes these motor schemas. Yeah, of course, only an insect of a certain size can fit inside an orchid, and can and the markings on the orchid will only elicit behavior in an organism that has a body that's has eyes and that can and like many flowers have their markings are only visible in ultraviolet light, so they might look sort of plain to human eyes, but to bees or wasps or whatever. They have these markings that attract them to land. The motor schema coordination is always relative to a particular body. And this, I think, we can tie this, Simon Don doesn't use this term, but around the same time as this text was being prepared, James Gibson developed the notion of affordances. An affordance is sort of what an entity sort of grants as perceptual, as behavioral capacities to an organism. So like when you see a floor, you perceive the floor as something you can walk upon or as walkable. The chair is something that you can sit on, but then a dog in your apartment doesn't see the chair as something to sit on, but as an obstacle to get around, for example. And so the various elements of the environment have these affordances. They present themselves as the counterpart to a certain behavior of an organism. And so there's this complicated interaction between the physical properties of the organism, the physical properties of the entity in the environment, and what sort of motor responses the organism or behaviors the organism can engage in in relation to that element of the environment, and it's this complex interaction that constitutes something as an affordance. I think it's a similar notion here, but maybe the emphasis is more like in Gibson, the the notion of an affordance is always sort of perceptual. So it's always something that you perceive in the environment. But here, I think the emphasis is more on the motor side or the behavioral side. So it's not just that the affordance is sort of grasped by the organism, but that the organism has these motor capacities or behavioral capacities that sort of elicit the affordances in the object, if that makes sense. So it's only because there are bees that are capable of perceiving ultraviolet light and, you know, landing on certain types of surfaces and so on, that that flowers, you know, produce these structures. You know, evolutionarily, there's this sort of complex interaction between bees and flowers and so on. Yeah, then there's this bit, I'm surprised no one brought up this bit about Jung and the inheritance of these motor schemas, which Simondon doesn't sort of dismiss out of hand. It seems, I mean, the idea that like the concepts or the image of a dragon is a inheritance of like our distant reptilian ancestors seems pretty implausible to me, but Simondon doesn't dismiss it. He says it's interesting, although conjectural. But he talks about what he presents what he described what it seems like a more plausible idea when in connection with images of flight, for example. So human images of flight. So many people have, you know, dreams of flying, and they're, you know, throughout history there have been various attempts to produce flying machines. Like there's the myth of Icarus and so on. So Simondon takes it that this is not sort of a hereditary memory of our distant ancestors who were able to fly, but instead it's a kind of observation. So human beings, of course, see birds and other flying animals in their environment, and then sort of transpose this schema of action onto their own bodies. So we sort of take we take our arms to correspond to the bird's wings, and we sort of picture ourselves flapping our arms to produce flight or something along those lines. And then Simondon points out that all these attempts at flying, the early attempts generally involved sort of an extension of the idea of a long jump. So you run and then you jump and you fly through the air for a couple meters and then land. And then the idea is sort of like, what if we could just fly not just for 2 meters, but like 20 meters or 200 meters or whatever. But of course, most flying organisms, birds and so on, they don't like run to jump and then sort of extend that jumping action. Like if you watch a bird take off, it sort of just takes off in place. It doesn't sort of run and then jump. So Simondon takes this to be a kind of transposition of the flying action onto human motor schemas. So we have, you know, these capacities to run and jump. So humans sort of take this as like corresponding to the motor schema of bird flight, even though it doesn't actually resemble bird flight in any sort of straightforward way. Okay, so let's go on to subsection 4. So we're on page 35 for those who joined us a bit later. If someone would like to read, subsection 4 is a bit longer. So maybe if you can read like the first page or so, and then we'll stop there, and then we'll read the rest of it after. So we can get a volunteer. There's no volunteers. I guess I can read. A page, or Angus, do you want to read?
Yeah, I can read another page.
Okay.
If anybody else wants to jump in for a later reading, that would be great. Subsection 4, spontaneity of motor anticipations during autogenesis. Studies by embryologists Coghill, Carmichael, show that motor development may be contemporary with perceptual development, but that it is neither posterior nor subordinated to it at every step. In other words, the putting in play of perceptual development through its exercise or through learning implies a reference to objects. That implies a reference to objects is not necessary for the appearance of organized schemas in motor development. The motor anticipation of behavior occurs by way of endogenous development. The organization of movement during ontogenesis is not a sequence of reactions. It has its own laws that are not drawn from perception, nor do they result from the influence of the milieu. This autonomous reality of virtual behaviors is an organic basis for anticipation and constitutes one of the bases for motor images. Coghill has studied the ontogenesis of swimming behavior in the Urodela family, salamanders, which appears endogenously as a progressively developing and differentiating form. In a related experiment, Carmichael has shown that chemically induced immobilizations lasting for several days do not delay full access to motor capability. Weiss, still with Urodela's, has shown that organized schemas of movement inhere in nervous organization and the structure of the body. The transplanting of limbs perturbs acting reactions to the point that no learning, even after a year, can compensate the effects of limb inversion. Analogous results were obtained by Grohman when studying the onset of flying movements in pigeons by immobilizing a control group. In this line of research, that of Cortland is especially important, for it shows that in a complex behavior, the first sequences to appear during ontogenesis are the activities of execution that correspond to the phase of consummation, which, within that behavior as a whole, comes last. Thus, young cormorants possess the motions used to fix twigs in the construction of a nest before they know how to carry, pick up, or look for these twigs. The most purely motor and most stereotyped activities of execution, then, cannot at first be exercised on an object, for the preparatory phases of seeking and transporting the behavior are missing. Anticipation begins with the end of the complete actual behavior. On the basis of this observation, which has a general reach, we can grasp one of the causes of the imaginary activity of anticipation. The organism possesses a know-how that would have meaning only if the problem of the search for the object was resolved. Such operative power elicits a substitute as an objective support. So these behaviors that only apply to the final stage of an activity, I think he later on gives the example of a kitten attacking a ball or your hand. These activities only correspond to basically the after the prey has been caught and in the case of the fixing the twigs, after the twigs have been found, and precedes the knowledge of how to catch the prey or find the twigs. And I guess that's the argument, is that this means that this behavior precedes the actual perception of the object that is needed for the finding of the twigs or the catching of the prey.
Yeah, so here, this is again connected with the text that we read, the last text in Individuation, the Form Information Potentials, where he talks about this development of human infant behavior, where human infants, for example, will transition from a crawling form of movement to a walking form of movement. And this is a sort of spontaneous development. Like, you don't have to like teach an infant how to walk. They just sort of start walking on their own. Simondon takes it that organisms have this endogenous motor development. So it's not just that they have a sort of preset set of behaviors. So he's talked about some of these behaviors that are characteristic of organisms in the previous subsection, but also they have a sort of characteristic pattern of learning behaviors. So they aren't born necessarily knowing how to build a nest, for example, but they acquire these capacities to perform these species-specific actions in a species-specific way in a certain order of progression. And that order of progression isn't necessarily tied to perception, as he points out here. So the cormorants that know how to, or they exhibit the capacity to put the twigs together into a nest before they exhibit the capacity to find the twigs in the first place. So it's clear that they aren't sort of inductively learning that if I pick up twigs and put them in this order, it makes a nest. They have this sort of motor schema of a nest construction prior to the actual perceptual encounter with the twigs that that they use to build the nest. So yeah, so it's again like at a higher level of structuration of they're capable of exhibiting this behavior prior to the perceptual encounter with the object that is the sort of normal counterpart to that behavior.
Hello. Yeah, sorry. Hope you can hear me clearly. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Just one observation. From what you're saying, it kind of appears there's a kind of anthropomorphization of this activity, because they're kind of like using terms like perceptual behavior, as if there is some kind of formation of thinking within the animal. I don't know. What do you think?
I think the idea here is that these motor schemas are happening before perception. So what I was trying to describe in the previous subsection is that these motor schemas are related not to something that resembles that humans would identify as the object of perception. So the wasp that lands on the orchid, the orchid doesn't look like a wasp to a human. It's not that, we sort of confuse the orchid with a wasp. But it has these sort of perceptual traits that elicit the behavior of the wasp. And so I think in that sense, it's not an anthropomorphism, because it's not sort of ascribing human-like cognitive capacities to these animals. It's instead trying to understand their behavior in terms of the specific perceptual traits that elicit that behavior. So whether it's a color contrast or a certain shape or a certain type of movement or whatever, when they perceive this perceptual, or I shouldn't even say perceive, because this is prior to perception in the proper sense of the term, but when they are exposed to this sort of element of the environment, it elicits their behavior in this way that doesn't involve object perception. It doesn't involve recognizing a certain type of object as falling under a category, for example. It just involves this response to features of the perceptual environment. So I think in that sense, it's not an anthropomorphism. I'm not sure what adjective I would use to describe it, but I don't think it's anthropomorphic in that sense.
Yeah, I just wonder if it's. I think I'm reading this text. I mean, I think it seems to be what's the word? There's kind of vein of that run through it, that kind of anthropomorphization, which is probably can't be avoided. I would imagine, because there are terms which imply understanding and things like that. I mean, I understand it's not, it's obviously it's written for us, but it does seem to have that. But anyway, that's just an observation. It's not a kind of a major criticism or anything.
Yeah, I guess so. What has sometimes been objected to ethology from a more sort of behavioristic point of view is, so ethology, the study of animal behavior, often talks about, in the sort of classical ethology tradition of Lorenz and Tinbergen, they have this, often they'll talk about drives of organisms, so a mating drive or a hunger drive and so on. This was sort of derived from psychoanalytic theory as sort of the proximal origin of this concept. So some more sort of behavioristically inclined researchers were, would object to this use of terms like drive and saying, like, you can't sort of project a human experience of having a drive to, a sexual drive or something. You can't sort of project that onto animals and use that to interpret animal behavior. But I think the way that this ethological tradition uses these terms is So it's definitely not a behavioristic approach to animal behavior, but Lorenz, for example, defended himself against the claim of anthropomorphization. So he talked about love in geese, for example, and he defends himself against the objection that this is an anthropomorphization of goose behavior, and he sort of he argues that we can identify the sort of patterns of behavior in geese and with certain patterns of behavior in humans. So for example, that geese will mate for life. They select a particular mate and they stay with them for the rest of their life. And they exhibit distress when they're separated from their mate and so on. Like, you can identify behaviors that sort of correspond to human behaviors without in a sort of abusive way anthropomorphizing. So by describing a goose as loving its partner, you're not necessarily anthropomorphizing in the sense that you're not saying that the goose has a similar sort of inner life as a human being that loves their partner, but you're sort of saying that the relationship to the partner is in some way corresponds to the relationship to a human partner in the sort of overall behavioral repertoire of these animals. So it plays a similar role in a sense that separation from the partner brings about distress, and the various motor responses or behavioral responses that show distress and so on. So I think that's sort of what the worry about anthropomorphism looks like in the context of ethology, and also the type of response that this sort of classical ethological school would give. So it's not a sort of claim to know what the inner life of a goose or a cormorant or whatever it looks like. It's instead identification of a particular element of the behavioral repertoire of an organism as corresponding to the another element in the behavioral repertoire of humans. But yeah, this is a sort of recurring issue in animal behavior, is that, you know, just to be able to, if we want to do anything that resembles understanding animal behavior and not just sort of, listing properties, this organism moved 3 meters east at this time or something like that. If you want to sort of understand, you know, why they're doing things or what meaning these actions have for them or something along those lines, then we have to translate it into human terms. We have to say, you know, this behavior in some sense corresponds to this human behavior that we have some intuitive grasp of. But then, of course, if you are translating animal behavior into human terms, then you're to some extent, diverting it from what it's meaning might have for that animal. You're sort of necessarily putting into human terms when it's not actually a human behavior. We can probably compare this to the Kant's arguments about teleological judgment. So Kant argues that we, in biology or in the study of living beings, we have to understand things in terms of functions. So we have to say that a wing is for flying, or fur is for keeping warm, or something like that, even though we can't identify an intelligence as, it's not a scientific explanation to say that there is like an intelligence that sort of selected for the purpose of making animals stay warm. We have to use these judgments, these teleological judgments, Kant argues, but we can't give them a scientific content. So in the same way in ethology, we have to sort of use our human transposition of animal behavior, even though we can't take that human transposition as like the true representation of what that animal behavior really means to that animal.
Yeah, I wonder if the other way around, though, is the actual underlying point of this, though. I mean, might it not be that the point of this is that rather than applying human behavior to animals, it's animal behaviors are being applied to humans.
Yeah, I think it's a sort of interactive relationship. So in ethology, we use our understanding of human behavior as a way of grasping animal behavior. But then in turn, once we have a certain amount of understanding of animals, in particular like primates and animals that are more closely related to us, when we have that understanding of primate behavior, for example, we can apply it to human behavior and learn something about human behavior that we wouldn't have recognized without sort of going through the detour of learning about chimpanzees, for example. So yeah, that we can learn about animal behavior by using, or we have to use our human understanding to try to learn about animal behavior. But then once we do learn something about animal behavior, we can apply that understanding to try to learn more about more about our own human behavior. And then presumably that would help us in future also learn more about animal behavior again in this sort of spiraling pattern. Okay, so let's go on to the next subsection at the top of 30, or sorry, not the next subsection, but the next reading section. So from top of page 36, play behaviors and vacuum activities, if I can get a volunteer.
I mean, I would do it, but I can't get the PDF up while I'm, because I'm on push to talk, so I can't get the PDF up while I'm while I'm talking. So I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, that's the downside of a push to talk. Yeah, you had to switch to push to talk because of the mic issue. Yeah, okay. So I'll read the next page, and then hopefully we can get a volunteer for the next one if someone else has the technical capacity to do it with their current setup. Okay, play behaviors and vacuum activities may be interpreted at least partially through the genesis that inverts the sequence of behaviors. When the execution phase of a behavior is ready, it can be actualized in relation to a substitute object, that is, one endowed only with features supporting the motor activity. A young cat, capable of seizing with his claws and biting, but not of seeking and detecting prey, may take as prey substitute almost any kind of object. A bobbin with thread or a woolen ball, because the image of the prey remains foremost, a bundle of capture motions. The same almost random object may also occasion different motor plays, capture, posturing, intimidation, etc. In humans, instinctual behaviors also show up in reverse order. Recruiting substitutes for play as a preliminary exercise of execution activities when the activities of preparation and search are not yet possible. Hence, playing with dolls corresponds to the end of the sequence of reproductive behaviors at a time when sexual immaturity prevents the preliminary phase of that behavior. All that is required is a basic and almost random object, teddy bear, a rag ball, a pet. What matters is that the object can be cradled, rocked, and carried along. It is the support and aim of preformed movements constituting a pattern. Perceptual resemblance plays a much lesser role here than its motor adequacy as a substitute. Whence the error of adults who, unmotivated, construct dolls for children that are art objects or automata perceptually mimicking an actual child, from the point of view of perception. For the purpose of playing, such constructions are worth no more than a rag doll, unformed by perceptual norms, but conforming to the motor patterns of the child. The essence of playing is pre-perceptual. Primary and instinctual play needs no perceptual figuration, only a great variety of random objects that can be recruited by motor tendencies, grouped in configurations. If we add that motor capacities create a need when they reach full development, we can then understand the presence of specific powers of recruiting random objects as motor supports of motor tendencies in adults, aggression, protection, when such tendencies are not absorbed by situations integrated into daily life. For example, the adoption of pets treated maternally by adults or hunting and ritualized killing. In both cases, the image devolves not from objective features of the substitute objects, but from the configuration of prior motor tendencies. Human beings may themselves be recruited as support for motor play, that is, become images of what must be fought against, rejected from the group, or sexually sought. Collective phenomena are grafted on this recruitment activity coming from pre-perceptual motor tendencies, but the first condition of possibility of such phenomena is the existence of prior motivations. One source of motivation is constituted by the inherence in the individual of organized motor sequences corresponding to a need to act according to an orientation defined by such motor sequence. Right, so this is just a sort of further development of the point from the last passage we read. So again, the emphasis here is that these motor behaviors are not related to perception in the sense of identifying an object as falling under a certain category. So it's not that the kitten looks at a ball of wool and says, yeah, that looks like a mouse, I'm going to attack it. It's that there are these sort of very general elements of an environment, or very schematic elements of an environment, that elicit motor behaviors. And Simondon points out here that the motor behavior elicited by a particular object can vary depending on the motivational state of the organism. So the kitten might treat the ball of wool as a prey object at one point, and attack it, and try to capture it, and so on. And then later on, it might sort of pretend it's another cat and try to intimidate it or something. Various different play behaviors might be elicited by the same object, because it's only these very general properties of the object that are required, a sort of vague shape or a certain type of movement or something like that, that that are required to elicit these motor schemas. And he points out that in humans, we also have these sort of play behaviors, or these behaviors that are prior to the actual manifestation of a certain type of behavior. So he talks about certain types of toys that children play with, and dolls in particular, as corresponding to reproductive behavior, the final stage of reproductive behavior when you actually have an infant. But of course, this happens long before humans are capable of reproducing. Again, he points out that the doll doesn't need to actually resemble a child. And in some respects, it's actually better when it doesn't. It has to do with the types of motor behavior that the object affords, as opposed to the sort of perceptual properties of this object. So an object like a very elaborate doll that resembles a human being, but is like fragile and has a hard surface, for example, is less useful to a child, or is less usable as a child, as a substitute infant, than like a bundle of rags that has like sort of a vague arm and leg shape that the child can carry as if it were an infant, and so on. It's the motor behaviors that an object affords that are relevant to the play behavior of the child, as opposed to like perceptual resemblance to the object that the final behavior will correspond to.
It's interesting, this idea that there are sort of collective motor behaviors that function the same way, so that I guess you would have a kind of collective preparation to fight, for instance, that can recruit these motor anticipations can recruit a given human being as the object for those behaviors, in the same way that, a kitten can recruit a woolen ball as a prey object.
Yeah, I think he's probably thinking here of, there's a sort of tradition in France, especially of crowd psychology. There's Gustave Le Bon that Freud references. I think that's maybe what he has in mind here. So there's like, and these are often pretty ugly phenomena where a crowd will sort of identify someone as, the foreigner or the deviant in some way, as someone to be attacked. And there might be some sort of vague perceptual trigger of this behavior, but this human behavior of a crowd sort of brings it elicits these responses of attacking, or these sort of general responses to a particular type of entity. It could be based on something very vague, like their clothing style is like different than ours or whatever. There's some sort of vague perceptual or pre-perceptual eliciting element about this person, and that brings about crowd responses as, you know, this person is a person to be attacked or something like that. So I think that's that type of phenomenon that he has in mind here when he talks about collective motor responses. Yeah, and this is something, yes, Twitter and social media in general sort of amplify some of these types of responses and in a maybe a more abstract vein. So it's not a sort of direct physical interaction with a person as to be attacked, but you have like a sort of representation of a person, you know, on Twitter because of whatever they post something bad, and then they become the main character of the day, and then everyone has to you know, attack them. And yeah, social media sort of amplifies some of these responses in this like more abstract vein, where we identify a person as to be attacked or to be defended or something, based on, you know, not like, you know, that I've identified this as a good person or a bad person or whatever, but like these sort of pre-perceptual traits that you respond to in their sort of presentation of themselves on social media. Okay, do we have any volunteers to read the next page up to the subsection break?
Yeah, I can read it from a phone, actually. I've just realized I can do it that way.
Oh, sure. Yeah, okay. Thanks.
Just tell me if you can't quite hear me. I'm not sure the level I'm coming over.
Yeah, it's good for now. Yeah.
Okay, such opportunities for separate or, in a way, insular functioning would not be produced if the ontogenetic development of behavior was accomplished according to a plan of absolute simultaneity in the growth of subsets. In fact, Gesell has shown that the ontogenesis of behavior is similar to growth. Not only does it proceed according to principles of polarity, orientation, and according to gradients, and not homogeneous, like the inflation of a ball, but it is effectuated in successive cycles by dedifferentiations that prepare new structurations. Each stage ends its cycle with a defined behavior that might suffice unto itself, were it not a phase of a broader genesis, a compare prone progression in human infant. Temporarily abandoned, this behavior will be reincorporated in its essential axes within the final, more complex and synthetic pattern. Such essential axes within a behavior may be considered to provide the behavior the content of behavior anticipating motor images. These axes also allow for play, not merely as a non-coordinated motor expenditure, but as a gestaltized organization of movements generally focalized on an object support, ball, doll, etc. The role played by learning in definitive conduct may be considerable without taking anything away from the primitive aspect of motor images, corresponding to partial systematizations of behavior. In humans, learning can modify sensory motor adaptations in important ways and with great plasticity, as demonstrated by experiments on the effects of wearing prismatic deforming glasses. But such learning intervenes mostly in the context of motor perceptual relations and not in the reorganization of the motor gestalt. It is the availability of the motor gestalt with the needs corresponding to the exercise of this constitute availability that forms the basis for the recruitment of random objects as images, as image supports. Indeed, the phenomena of learning aids, aiming to insert a configuration of movements in the real and concrete motor perceptual milieu, also exist among animals in connection with the most stable and most clear motor stereotypes. The flight schema is innate in birds, but this a priori schema does not take into account the angle of flight, the necessity of compensate for wind speed and when landing, etc. The insertion of the schema in the milieu requires an apprenticeship of a different kind than playing, and it implies recourse to perceptual data rather than to images.
You can continue the last short paragraph there.
Okay. These remarks are not meant to solve the problem mentioned above of the origin of apparently a priori motor schemas like those that trigger flight images in humans with rather strong motivations. Perhaps these are extremely primitive motor schemas, like the reactions of or free motions of the fetus floating in amniotic fluid, which liberates it from the constraining effects of gravity through the effects of hydrostatic pressure. The primitive and broad character of such a motor schema may well animate images all the way to the intuition of orbital flight with a relative freedom in relation to the cockpit. But this is only a possible conjecture among others regarding the origin of movement images.
Right. So he brings up again this the studies that I mentioned in relation to form information potentials, these studies of human behavioral ontogenesis that show human infants going through these phases of sort of well-adapted behavior, like crawling. Infants are capable of getting around in, you know, in a house or an apartment very efficiently by crawling. And then at some point, the crawling behavior sort of falls apart. The infant starts to, you know, crawl in this awkward way and have difficulty crawling. But then after maybe a couple of days or so, that sort of awkward crawling behavior is transformed into walking. So now the infant is capable of walking on 2 feet instead of crawling on four limbs. And so there are these cycles of well-adapted behavior, then de-adaptation, and then re-adaptation at a new form of behavior. So Simondon is so he identifies that aspect, but then he points to the sort of complicated question of to what extent learning plays a role in the development of behavior. In many organisms, there's a complicated interaction between this sort of maturation of the developmental patterns. Like human infants will learn to walk without any sort of instruction. You don't have to teach infants how to walk. There's also learning in that the infant, so the sort of precise length of the infant's leg is constantly changing as they're growing, and they're growing quite quickly at that age. So they have to sort of not just learn how to walk in general, but learn how to walk with a leg, you know, this precise many millimeters long. And that's constantly changing from like 1 week to the next. So they have to constantly adapt their behavioral schemas to the specific body that they are incorporated in, and the specific environment. Like they might learn to walk on carpet and then find that it's difficult to walk on sand or grass or whatever. They have to learn to adapt that walking behavior to different surfaces. There's a variety of interactions between the sort of maturation of behavior and the adaptation of behavior to specific factors of the environment through learning. And Simondon just points out that that there's this learning is sort of a separate question from this maturation of behavioral schemas, and it's probably something more sophisticated than sort of spontaneous maturation. Then he mentions he just sort of mentions in passing in parentheses here these experiments involving deforming prisms as an instance of learning. There were some experiments, I think, in the 30s, 1930s, of like subjects were given these like goggles, I guess, that had these sort of mirrors in them, which inverted the perceptual image. So everything you see is upside down. And what the subjects reported is that, and so they wore these for like, I think, a week or several days at least. And what subjects reported is that at first everything looks upside down, like you see everything as if it's upside down. But then they found that after a while, everything sort of looked normal. And especially this was the case when they were allowed to move around and manipulate objects and so on. So when they interact in a motor way with the environment, they eventually just come to see the world as like, this is just the way the world looks, is like, this way, and they don't see things as upside down anymore. Whereas subjects that were not allowed to move around and manipulate objects took longer to reach that stage of seeing things as being right side up. But Simon notes, so this is an instance of learning. So this is the other sort of mode of development of behavior that Simondon wants to distinguish from the maturation of behavior. That's what he means, or that's what he's referring to when he talks about these experiments with these deforming lenses. And then right at the end of that passage, he brings up, I think, an interesting hypothesis about the permanence or remnants of our sort of motor schema of floating in amniotic fluid as a fetus. So our sort of earliest experiences, as you know, even prior to our birth, are of sort of this free floating in a fluid. And he suggests that this may also play a role in the sort of impulse towards flight that human beings have exhibited throughout history. So he earlier talked about like perceiving birds as probably one of the sources, but then also maybe this floating experience at the fetus plays a role in making humans feel like flight is something natural or something that they should direct themselves toward. And then even more than flight, but floating in a zero gravity situation in Earth orbit, the types of motor behavior that astronauts exhibit. So astronauts are, of course, capable of moving around in a space station or something like that, so they might be sort of recruiting these motor patterns that were developed as when they were fetuses. Those patterns are re-emerging in a completely different environment when they're adults.
Yeah, I think it's interesting when he talks about the we can play, but then when we come up against the reality of the environment, then there's a different type of learning involved. Sorry, I haven't got my just read.
The last bit cut out. I didn't hear what you said at the end. I don't know. There might be a mic issue, Derek. I'm not hearing anything. In connection with play, play has like both aspects are involved in play. So like the kitten that attacks a ball of wool is on the one hand just sort of undergoing the maturation process that will eventually lead to the capacity to actually catch prey and eat it and so on. It looks like Derek has a connection issue now. On the one hand, the play behavior is part of the maturation process of the sort of spontaneous endogenous development of behavior. But then on the other hand, in play, the organism also learns about different aspects of the environment and learns about its own body and, you know, the shape of its limbs and so on. So both processes are probably at work and in interaction with each other at the same time when an organism plays with an object in its environment. Okay, so we're pretty much out of time. For those outside of North America, we had our daylight savings time switch over last night. So we'll be an hour earlier in your time zone. Hopefully that still works for everyone. If you can join an hour earlier than previously. I know it's annoying with these time zone changes every 6 months or so. If that doesn't work, you can put a message in the schedule thread in the forum. And then I think parts of Europe will be changing over in a couple weeks. Keep an eye out for daylight savings changes in the next few weeks. Hopefully, I think the event in Discord hopefully will adjust automatically to your time zone. But
unless you're like using a VPN to change your connection, if you look at the event, it will automatically display the starting time in your time.
Right. Okay. So yeah. So check the event in Discord, and hopefully that should work properly, and you should see it in your time zone. So let's meet an hour earlier for those outside North America next week.